Hi, this is Katie Day, and welcome to Creating Ripples, the programme that showcases inspirational women over 50 across the globe. Sometimes the small acts and achievements can create the biggest ripples. We're here to share some amazing stories. They may make you laugh, sometimes they may make you cry. They will always inspire you. Today, I'm delighted to be speaking with Jane Best, OBE. Jane is CEO of Refugees International Japan and lives in Tokyo, and she is currently live with me via Skype. In 2000, Jane took up a volunteer position with RIJ as funding director, and in 2006, she was appointed president and CEO of the organisation. This followed 12 years in Tokyo running a British restaurant with her husband, and also included several other projects. A second restaurant, a bar, and some outside catering. Since Jane joined RIJ, she has visited projects they fund in a variety of countries, including Thailand, Burma, Sri Lanka, Colombia, Bosnia, Gambia, Guinea, Liberia, Lebanon, Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, Zambia, and South Africa. This year, Jane is planning to visit Jordan and Turkey in March. Jane, thank you so much for giving up your time to be a part of Creating Ripples. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
You're very welcome. So how did you end up in Tokyo to start with?
I, after working in Zambia, I was back in, I've been back in the UK and for a good 5 or 6 years, and I was getting very, very restless again,
right,
and wondering where to go. And I had a letter from somebody who was here in Tokyo, and I thought, okay, it's different from Africa.
Yeah.
So I came out of interest, pure interest, and actually only on a 3-week holiday.
Oh my gosh.
And decided to come back, and I was drifting a bit, really. But I discovered Southeast Asia, which is just fascinating.
Wow. So you've never been to any part of Southeast Asia before then?
No, not at all. In fact, I hadn't been anywhere very much, really. I suppose I'd been to the States and Zambia and several countries around there.
Sure.
And a very little bit of Europe. In fact, I've seen less of Europe than I've seen in the rest of the world.
What were you doing in Zambia?
I was teaching management and food management. For example, the students that I was working with, we went on school meals projects and hospital catering and looking at that side of food management.
Okay. And how long are you doing that for? You said you were working with the VSO for 2 years, Voluntary Service Overseas.
Yes, I was 2 years with VSO doing the teaching, and then I was recruited to do training with the National Hotels Corporation, which was a wonderful job, travelling to all the places around the country, but I wasn't really making a huge impact. So,
okay.
I suppose ideology got the better of me at that age, and I came back to the UK.
So after your 3-week sort of drifting holiday in Japan, what was the next stage in the journey to ending up there permanently?
A lot of people you'll speak to say, you know, I came here for a few weeks and I'm still here, sort of thing.
Right.
So I couldn't tell you when that happened. I came back. I was 3-week holiday, and I went back and worked my notice in UK.
Right.
And then came back, as I say, just fell in love with Southeast Asia and just did lots of travelling and just earning enough to keep me here. But at some point, but by then I was with my husband, who still my husband. we decided, we were talking about it, you know, shall we stay here? If we stay in Japan, we should do something a bit more substantial than survival.
Right.
And I can't tell you how we got to that decision, but we got to the decision of opening a restaurant. And that's why we stayed, because we opened a business. And
okay.
And once you do that, you've got your roots set in. And when we closed the restaurant, you know, we were out of the system. So is it better to stay where you know people or move on again?
Is your husband British?
Yes.
What took him out to Japan?
He had been here a couple of years before I arrived, and basically he'd also worked in Africa. That's where I met him.
Okay.
In the beginning, and he was back in UK, not in Maggie Thatcher's Britain, not able to find a job, basically.
Right.
That's how he always explains it, anyway.
Okay.
And so he went looking somewhere else for a job. So.
So when you started your British restaurant in Tokyo, what year was that?
1988.
Were there many British restaurants in Tokyo at the time? Were you quite an anomaly?
There were no British restaurants at the time, and there still aren't particularly.
Right.
Interesting, it's just not something that people have taken up very much. There are now a lot of British pubs.
Are there?
And they do quite reasonable... several of them do quite good British food, but there are no restaurants.
So how were you received?
Generally okay. I mean, it was probably 60% Japanese customers and 40% British.
Okay.
I mean, it had its good and its bad days. But generally speaking, it was okay. You'd always approach it by saying, well, I know the British food's got a bad reputation. That would make people relax, and then they come and try it.
Okay. It's a good way to start.
You know, disarm people. Yeah. It's amazing how that works.
Yeah. Before they can complain, just tell them.
Yeah.
So how did you get involved originally with Refugees International Japan? It was back in 2000, and you started off with a volunteer position. But how did you... find out about the organisation, and how did you get involved with them?
I'd known about it for some time.
Right.
I knew quite a few people who worked in it. It was all volunteer at that time.
Right.
Several people knew of my work in community work. I mean, we'd always done something with a cause or another, and we used the restaurant a lot for events. But I couldn't get involved in it because restaurant work's pretty full on, and there's not a lot of time for other things. And so when we closed the restaurant, several friends in RIJ asked me if I'd join them.
Right.
So it was a question I'd known about it for some time.
Okay.
And they just leapt on me because they knew I'd be interested.
Okay. So the funding director, which is where you started as a volunteer... what did that involve? Were you fundraising with individuals? Were you going after corporate companies? Was it just within Japan?
I was, as funding director, I was responsible for the projects. I was responsible for spending the money.
Right.
So everyone else had to do the fundraising.
I see.
Until that changed in 2006.
Right.
I think actually the title was International Funding Director. In other words, I was looking at where the projects were that were worthy of funding and monitoring them, or choosing them, monitoring them, and so on, which was very much very suited to my background and my interest.
Right.
And so on. I later had to learn about fundraising when I got appointed CEO.
Right. So tell us a bit more about RIJ, Refugees International Japan.
It was started in 1979.
Gosh.
In response to the Cambodian problem.
Right.
The Pol Pot Khmer Rouge regime. And a group of people got together here in Tokyo to advocate for better conditions in the camps in Thailand.
Right.
Over the years, people who were involved then have moved on, and one person in particular, Sue Morton, who was one of the first people involved, she, when she got back to the States, continued her advocacy work. The group here became more of a funding group because, I suppose it's because advocacy doesn't sit well with Japanese.
Right,
generally,
right.
Obviously they're getting better and better and busier at it, which is great to see. but in those, you know, back in 1979, the foreigners would move on regularly, and the Japanese who were running it were more on to just fundraising, and then what to do with that. So the group here grew up as a funding group, and there's a group in Washington that still does advocacy and so on. They're called Refugees International.
Right.
And we see ourselves as sister organisations, but we are completely separate in terms of administration, finance, and mandate, if you like.
So how did it expand from that initial driver, that initial passion to do something and make a difference, to the organisation that it is today?
Well, I wasn't here in the beginning. But it was... It was very much bubble time when it got going, the famous bubble economy in Japan, and there was a lot of money flowing around, and it expanded quite well, very, very much on events, very much a sort of social organisation. And it's gone through different scenarios over the years. And when we reorganised in 2006... We restructured it a lot, and it became more of an NGO as opposed to a community event organisation.
Okay.
And it's expanded in that way, in terms of a very, very clear mandate and a very solid base to the organisation. But in terms of fundraising, it changes every year. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not.
Yeah.
We all know about fundraising.
What is the criteria for choosing the projects that you support?
We would look at how many beneficiaries, of course. I mean, that's probably what everyone looks at. But we particularly look at how it's going to create opportunities for people, and that it's being run by people on the ground, it's being run by refugees, or what we call internally displaced people who have not moved out of their country, but that they are running it, that they can see a future for what they're doing, and that it's going to take people into a better, give them a better future, better outlook, that we believe that the refugees are looking for normality. They're looking for a normal life as possible. And what they really want is to get out of dependence.
Right.
And therefore, the projects that we're funding are providing these opportunities that they can use their own skills and talents and move the things forward for themselves. I talk about recovering and rediscovering. So once you've recovered from the trauma of losing control of your life, which must be a horrible experience, that then people can become more productive, regain their self-respect. And all groups have just amazing talents, and so it's allowing those talents to re-emerge, and or learning new skills as well.
How do you work in partnership and alongside any other NGOs?
We might in some areas. When you say work, we fund, and we fund groups that are actually doing the projects.
Right.
In some instances, there may be a larger NGO overseeing it, which is necessary. If we can't get there, we can't be on the ground in all these places because we don't have staff. Yes, there are partnerships, but generally speaking, it could be just a local community group, or it could be a bigger NGO or an INGA.
And how do you look at the sustainability of the projects that you get involved in? Is there measurement and strategies in place to look at the sustainability?
Yes, we would ask them how they're going to measure results, where it's going to take people, what they're going to do beyond the project. For example, if it's leadership community training, what the so-called graduates are going to do beyond that, and what their aims are. And we follow up in the certain projects that we've been funding for quite a few years now, and we've seen huge benefits as to where people have gone on to and what they're doing. Amazing. Quite amazing.
It must be incredibly humbling as well. and, well, and inspiring.
It's inspiring. Yeah. When you see the resilience of people and the determination to make things better for themselves, it's just brilliant. It really is.
I mean, we really have no idea, do we, of what real hardship and trauma is. You know, we think, you know, certain things happen in our lives and we think it's, and you know, it is difficult, it is challenging, and, you know, trauma is on a sliding scale, and it's our individual reaction to that and perception of that from our view of the world. But in comparison to some groups of people around the world with everything that's going on, we are incredibly privileged. And I sometimes wonder if in the West we forget just how privileged we really are.
I think we probably do. I mean, it's inevitable, to be honest, because there's so much now, and it's materialism, and we have so many things. I think what is hard to understand is that, or to remember, is that we do have a lot of choice. Whereas if you lose control of the situation because you have to run from home and all that holds you there, you don't have any choice. You really landed up without any kind of options. And we'll often groan, oh, we can't control that, we can't control this. But actually, we got loads of control and we got loads of choices. And that's what I think we're ungrateful about. And me too, I'm sure, a lot of the time. So it's great to see what people are doing in some of the projects we fund.
Yeah, choices is really, we do forget actually the incredible choices that we do have. What are some of the projects, say, that you're most proud of, or the ones that you found most inspiring? What are some of the success stories that you've had?
Well, there are a lot, but one, some in particular that I would pick out is where the projects have given youth in the community opportunities, because, you know, I'm sure we all have rebellious times or awkward times in our youth, and we know how difficult we can be, and it's just a terrible time for people who've got no future prospects and so on. Mm. And so to give to the projects which has given the youth a role in the community, and they're so proud of what they're doing, are brilliant, really, really very good. I was just in Nairobi 2 months ago, and seeing how people live in the city in an urban situation where there is very little support, they have a degree of freedom that people in camps don't have, but equally they don't have support that people in camps have.
Right.
And they'd opted to do the training that was being provided with our funds, and seeing how they were setting up businesses and doing being independent within the city was just fascinating, you know, amazing. And there was one guy who really stood out because he's also a musician, youngish man, and he'd done a video and written some music, and he'd won a prize in New York.
Wow.
And he was running this business. He was just so much going on that he was really driven to...
Gosh.
And constant smile on his face.
Gosh, I mean, that's a phenomenal story, isn't it? And how heartening, like, when you hear things like that.
Yes, and he's just one of many.
Yeah, yeah. Do you work alongside governments in these countries?
No. We would fund into the community, and as far as possible, we would avoid funding projects where there's any government control.
Okay. Do you have any resistance?
Wouldn't do anything wrong from a government point of view, but we wouldn't work with the government. So the refugees have the freedom to do it themselves.
Do you ever come up against any resistance from any of the countries that you work in?
Not really, because by the time we've approved the project, we would have established that there isn't difficulties running the project there and so on. So not to a large extent. But we often on visits will have to go meet the local authorities. It's polite, and B, to make sure that they are supportive of what's going on. But beyond that,
I mean, some of the areas that you go into are challenging.
Yes.
Challenging situations. What do you do for your own kind of due diligence and your own safety preparation?
Well, to an extent, I wouldn't go into a conflict zone, but then the refugees have fled the conflict zone. So, you know, hopefully. No, they're not very safe necessarily, but we'll check out how dangerous it is and get an update from the people. But also our hosts would advise us on any visit, plus the fact that we wouldn't want to put them in danger.
Of course.
So, we take care on that.
Yeah.
So due diligence in checking out and talking to the people on the ground.
So in 2006, you were saying the structure of the organisation changed and you became CEO. So what was that structure change?
There wasn't a two-tier governments. There wasn't a board of trustees and a management board. There weren't official teams on the administration side. So we structured it from that point of view and started to look at marketing and that kind of thing.
Right.
So it was more a kind of apportioning jobs and roles to different members of the team.
I see. Okay.
And employing somebody. I was the first person to be employed.
Were you?
So I was loved and hated in equal measure.
So talk us through a typical day. Is there such a thing as a typical day? I'm guessing there probably isn't.
No, not really, because, of course, working with a volunteer team, yes, you can try and do an office hour job, but then you can't. Volunteers aren't always available in that time because they've probably got jobs of their own. An average day of going to the office, I would go to the office, which is in Tokyo Bay, work with interns maybe for a few hours, and then I might have meetings to go and see supporters, donors, sponsors. I would avoid going back to the office, so if I've got meetings outside, I would try and have them before and at the beginning and the end of the day. But then another day I might never go into the office and have meetings.
Right.
And then I'll try a day working at home so I can catch up with myself.
Yeah. That's always the challenge for us all, isn't it? Constantly chasing our tails.
It is. And going to the office, it's amazing how hard it is to actually get down to anything specific, because there's always somebody asking something or calling in and so on. And with a volunteer team, it's pretty mixed. But it's rewarding. It's challenging with a volunteer team, but it's equally rewarding because they're doing it because they believe in what you're doing.
Yeah. So. How many volunteers do you have?
Well, I wouldn't... on a regular basis, about 30, probably.
Okay.
But in terms of coming into the office in any 1 week, between 6 and 10.
Do you still do the events?
Yes, we do events. I'd like to get more other activities going and sort of general support and donations, but no, events are still very important.
What are your key projects that you're working on at the moment?
You mean fundraising side?
Yeah.
We're about to have a cabaret and talent show.
Wow.
without the rude judges.
Yeah, there's definitely a market for that everywhere.
That's our second time to do this, and it was a huge success last year.
I bet it was.
It's a bit sort of different from a gala dinner, and it was the pricing was better. There was a huge amount going on all evening, so that's coming up in a couple of weeks.
Fantastic.
We've done a few events based on Call My Bluff.
Oh, really?
The British listeners will know that.
Yeah.
But it's based on the Great Wine Bluff or the Great Beer Bluff. And so, people have this one wine and they'll have to guess which one is the correct analysis. And that's a great fun evening.
Great fun.
We've had an F1 night on the simulators.
Really?
And then the usual running events and that kind of thing. We're doing a very interesting campaign coming up, which is sponsored by a large marketing company, called the Refugee Collection.
Right.
And this is a very interesting project, trying to get, because getting the message out to the public in Japan is quite a challenge because, you know, the media don't report on the refugee situation a lot. And so we're setting up this marketing PR campaign whereby we've got memorabilia from refugees.
Wow.
Things that mean something to them along with their stories. So, you know, we've actually got a prosthetic foot or some old bowls or we haven't got a teddy bear, but something like that. Old bags or cloths, you know, what they meant to them in running away
and how
they were so important. Somebody gave us a knife and he said he used that to cut down bamboo as a shelter and when he was running. So all sorts of odd things like that, and the stories go with it.
Mm.
Very, very poignant and a very strong way of getting the message across.
Incredibly strong.
To the public. So we've got that coming up in April, which is very, very interesting.
Amazing, amazing.
We brought these back. My trips.
Did
too. I hope that bag wasn't going to get searched with a prosthetic limb.
An interesting conversation to be having at customs.
I'm doing research in prosthetic limbs, yes.
And what about the projects that you're involved in the countries? What's happening this year? Are there any particular focus for this year?
You mentioned that I'm going on a visit to Jordan and Turkey. Obviously, Syrian issue is very high on the agenda. But I think something that we want people to remember is that there are 60 million people around the world that have been displaced by conflict, probably more actually, but those are the sort of official statistics. And so there's a hell of a lot of people who have been living in camps for 20, 30, 40 years.
Gosh.
And so to try and keep a focus on those as well, and they still need support in terms of opportunities to improve the situation for themselves. So yes, we're funding projects for Syrians, but also remembering, you know, some of our longer term partners. So the project I saw in Kenya, Thailand, a lot of three projects for Burmese refugees that we funded for a long time. So we'll continue that focus as well as looking at the Middle East.
Mm. Do you ever see a time in the future where RIJ won't be needed?
That would be nice, wouldn't it? But at the moment, the numbers are going up. So unfortunately not. I'd love to say, yes, we're going out of business, but it's just getting... The numbers are increasing, so and you know, it's nothing I can personally do about that, but hope to make things better for people in our small way.
It is hugely important, isn't it? It's a sad reflection, really, that you're needed. I mean, thank God you're there, but how sad that you are needed. Where do you see the future for RIJ? Where, as CEO, do you want to take the organisation? What's your vision?
I think we will always be a relatively small group because by being a smallish group, we can reach and get very close up to the projects that we're funding and identify with them. And the bigger you get, the less, you know, obviously the less you can keep as close to all the projects. So I'd like to see it expanding a bit from what we're doing now in terms of the number of projects we support, but maintaining very, very clear focus on providing opportunities, creating opportunities, getting people onto a better standing for themselves. Interestingly, I'm slightly diverting now, I hope you don't mind.
No.
The European crisis has highlighted, you know, how aid is given and so on, and how assistance is given. And several people have come out and said, it's not just a humanitarian issue, it should be seen as a development issue. And this is exactly what's behind, you know, the way we go about funding, is that it is for people to develop their communities, to develop stronger communities and so on. So we will continue to do that. let's hope my successor does well. I now can't speak for whoever follows me in the long term, but for the moment I'm here.
Good. I mean, that's really interesting, the point you say that it's a development issue, and it's looking at where can you find the positive, isn't it? And if we focus on the negative, that's what we get more of. But we actually look at what is the development opportunity here for the people here. Do you have the stories where people have managed to get out of the refugee situation and reinvent themselves in the country or in other countries, and then go back and support the people still in the camps?
Yes, I've seen individuals certainly are doing that. I mean, particularly on the Thai-Burma border, where we've been funding for quite a long time. A couple of the projects, you've seen people who've gone through the training are now doing the training themselves and taking that out into the community. So very definitely you see this flow of people, absolutely brilliant. I do emphasize the development side, because they are developing their communities, there's no doubt.
Do they still have a vision for themselves that they will be able to return?
Yes. People always want to return. And I think this is one of the myths about the public image of refugees. The majority of them want to return. Mm. I mean, they know they can't at the moment or wherever they are at the stage of life. But no, that's what they and that's why very few of them actually want to move away from the region that they come from, because they want to stay near home to return there. That comes back to the European thing as well, where people think they're all trying to get to Europe, but actually we're talking about 1 million people out of 60 million. So, you know, the majority of people want to stay near home and want to go home eventually.
That pull, isn't it, to our roots is incredibly strong.
Yeah. Very strong. I hadn't realised how strong, actually, as somebody who likes to wander around the world. I hadn't realised how strong it is, generally speaking.
So what about you personally? Do you see yourself staying in Japan, or do you see yourself returning to the UK at any time?
I don't know. I think, yes, I would probably return eventually. But I don't have any specific plans.
No immediate plans.
At the moment, no. I don't see myself as an old lady in Japan.
Okay.
I think that's what it comes down to.
Right.
Might say I'm an old lady now, but there we are.
You say that, but Japan has an incredibly good reputation for the health of their older generation. Actually far better than the UK.
Well, yes, and I mean, it's a good thing, because they have an extreme problem with an ageing population. and yes, the very good services and the great longevity. Longevity, how do you pronounce it? I think I'd like to be a doddery old lady in my own language.
Would
probably.
You? Have you read that wonderful book, When I'm Old, I'm Going to Wear Purple?
Yes, it's brilliant, isn't it?
And go along the railings.
I did it long ago.
Yeah. And spit
and
in the street.
I got a purple sweater on today. It's not purple, really.
And it is that pull, isn't it? And I kind of have a bit of a wanderlust as well. But, you know, there is something about your roots and where you were born that at some point is probably going to just kind of pull you back. Like that piece of elastic gets shorter and shorter and shorter.
Yes.
And you ping back to where you came from. Is your husband involved in the organisation with you, or is he completely separate, doing something
else? No, he's not. He's not involved in it. When I took on the role full time, I said to him he wasn't obliged to have to come and do it. So, he helps out from time to time on other things, but no, he's not involved.
Right, he does something completely different. Is he still involved in catering?
No, he teaches sort of English language business consultant with the senior people in Toshiba.
Fascinating.
Been doing that for years. Has and
he?
Years and years.
So if you were to sum up your experiences in Japan and with the organisation in a sentence, what would that be? What has it meant to you?
It's given me opportunities as well as providing other opportunities, and the opportunities have been tremendous. I've been to some great countries. I've met people who truly and utterly inspire me. And also, I've met some amazing people here in Japan. So, aren't I lucky?
How has it changed you?
Ooh, I don't know if it's changed me. I've always been curious and interested in getting out to know people and see the different situations. Maybe it's made me wiser, but who's going to judge that?
Yeah, exactly. That sounds like a very good place to end, Jane. Thank you very much.
We've got an argument.
Well, I think the only person who can judge how wise we are is probably ourselves, because we knew where we started.
Exactly. That's also very wise.
So this has been Katie Day, and you've been listening to Creating Ripples. Listen in and be part of the revolution that is rocking the world. Women over 50 are the new future. We are awesome, fearless, fabulous, inspiring, passionate, courageous. In fact, we just rock.